Hello.
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 Well, hey, everybody. This is Dave. How are you guys doing?
Hi, Dave.
Welcome.
Good, how are you?
Thanks for your emails and your responses and the questions you've sent. Let's begin. I want to have just a brief discussion at the beginning to offer a chance to have a discussion or any clarification about any of the concepts and the issues we talked about last time, and to really hear from you. Was there an important takeaway for you that would make a difference or be of benefit to you? So any of the above, I'm eager to hear, and it's all yours for response now.
What's Hi, Dave.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Devorah. I just wanted to know where I can go. I just wanted to know where I can go to download the recording from last week.
The same link that you got that from when you signed up for this, and the same link that I sent in the reminder when I asked the two questions.
Okay.
And that link will have the download for the outline and resources as well as the playback for each of the four seminars, and the playback will be posted by the next morning at least.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for your question. I think what you ask about creating a systematic way to proceed, a way to understand this is really crucial, and I definitely have that in mind. Leon asked a similar question about creating a system of how to think about this, how to apply it and look at it. So we've begun when we looked at the psychology of influence last time and some ways to begin to think about that. We're going to extend it to look at the neuroscience of persuasion and get more and more specific for you to develop a plan that will fit your story and your coaching. So okay. Thanks for that.
Wonderful.
Thoughts, questions, clarifications? Anything else from last time, say, you'd like to talk about or ask about?
Hey, Dave, this is Leon.
Yeah, go ahead, speaking of.
You know, one of the questions I wanted to ask is, I know last week we talked about the importance of why. And I've also come across where some folks say, you know, our customers don't care about our why. They just want to be, you know, they just want to know that we can help them. How do you see that as it relates to the importance of our why and why a customer, you know, will buy into our why or care about our why?
I don't think they will. I think we have to care about their why. We have to organize what we do as a benefit to someone. And, okay, here's the beginning. Draw a circle, each of you, draw a circle. A couple of you are familiar with this, but do it anyhow, again. Draw a circle. Inside that circle, draw a stick figure. Now, that stick figure is your potential client, or if you have products and you see it as customer, that's your potential customer. Now, the challenge, can I get a mute on the background because they're shuffling paper, and if you have an open mic, even movement will be picked up. So unless you're ready to talk, do a star six, but be sure and come off mute by star six again. So your challenge, if you want to communicate with that stick figure, that client or that customer, your challenge is to get inside the circle, because outside they won't listen to you. And I'm going to give you some illustration in this seminar about more of how to do that. But your challenge is to understand their experience and their challenge, their why and what they want to do and how you can benefit them. So you have to resonate with their experience. If it's a client, you're talking to that client, it's an empathic resonance. If it's a client who's a potential client, it's you need to understand what they need, what they have, and what they don't have, what you can provide. And think about your hub statement. For those of you who are familiar with that, it's the specific niche, because you know their challenge and their issues. You know where their gatekeepers, where the referral sources are, and a benefit that is unique to professional coaching that they will pay you for in 10 to 12 words or less. Because that's what will engage someone that they can't do or be themselves, is what they need from you that's unique to coaching, not what anybody else, any other professional can provide. So you need to get inside that circle to really engage that person and find out what their challenges are and how you can be of help to them. So it's them as a point of reference, not about your need or your ideas, but we bring an entire body of knowledge, of tools and methods and principles that we're going to apply. We're now applying some of what we know in the mind and brain and performance sciences to how to engage better, how to ask better questions, how to really resonate with somebody. And we began with the psychology of influence. We're going to extend it today to the neuroscience of persuasion. So this is an evolving, elaborate answer. You didn't expect me to be brief, did you? Or stick to the 10 words that I advocate for each of you, just because neuroscience says we attend to and retain up to 10 words. But that's my best answer. Does that make sense
to you,
Leon?
Absolutely. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Uh-huh.
Yeah, thank you. That does make sense. Thank you.
Okay, great. Did our last seminar begin to address that there was any kind of takeaway that was useful to you in that? And that was to you, Leon?
Oh, yeah. Well, for me personally, I mean, so much of it was valuable. I thought that, you know, even just the role playing of how you talk to a prospective client and how you invite them in as opposed to telling them what it is that you do, that was very, very helpful.
Good. Okay. Yeah. We know from conversational intelligence, there are some studies from neuroscience that show us that we engage and attend to up to 10 words, as we talked about. So it's helpful to speak clearly, briefly, and succinctly, as we touched on last time, because why not engage in conversation in ways that are consistent with what we know about the mind and brain, because that's going to optimize not only the connection, but how we go about resonating with someone's issue and going a new place together. And I think that's really an aspect of what we will be talking about in a number of ways in addition to where we began. So thanks for that. Any additional questions, thoughts, things that you'd like to be sure we discuss before we move into the content?
This is Jill Bedeska, David.
Please, go ahead.
Is there a textbook for this material?
I don't. That's why I have published 3 flip books, but I wouldn't send you to that because it's pretty much the same material. Now I apply this in specific ways to you, so I think you're getting a better benefit because it's current, even though those are published recently. So no, I don't have. I looked at a number of books, research, a number of things to put this together, and that's why I did an annotated outline and some resources there so you could refer to it, and encourage you to send in any additional questions or thoughts or anything else you want to cover. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the hopper about something you want to be sure we cover in our discussions?
I'll wait till you get through and see if you answer this metal question thing.
Okay, that's a deal. And that's why I really encourage the questions, discussion, anything you'd like to add, to be sure that it's applicable to you and to work. Here's one thing I would suggest. As we address each component of this, and especially more broadly, like at the end of this seminar, or maybe during the seminar, jot down your most important takeaway, and that will put it in an output channel for you, and it will make it more memorable because you're completing the circuitry in your brain. I'm going to move to lecture mode because I hear some background noise. I'll finish this thought in just a moment. I am not able to go on lecture mode. I'm going to ask each of you to go on mute, please. Star six. We're having some teleconference issues. If you would go on mute, and I trust you won't come off mute until the end. And my apologies about that. What we know now is when we put something in an output channel, it completes a circuitry in the brain. The most common, the simplest study of this I know is University of Waterloo did a study of two matched groups of people asking the group to read a passage in a book, half read it out loud, half read it silently. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on a test. They retained it. They made it more of a working knowledge for them. So let's move now to discussion of the neuroscience of persuasion. Here's the quiz, the persuasion quiz. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates and asked them to rate how much they wanted and liked various pleasurable activities. Here's the five options. Which of these do you think was the most endorsed of pleasurable activities for Ohio State University undergraduates? Receiving a paycheck, seeing a best friend, engaging in sexual activity, receiving a compliment or getting a good grade, eating a favorite food. Now, there's a hint here. One of these was endorsed as much as the other four combined. I'll come back to that. Jot down your answer. Persuasion can be defined as an active process of choice architecture, which is exactly our specialty in coaching, by the way, choice architecture, to get a prospect to clearly associate a desired feeling and outcome with your product or service. The most significant thing that great persuaders and understand and communicate. It's not about you, it's about them. And remember your primary question. What is it that you want to accomplish through this? Now, I hope that distinguishes a little bit better even my answer to Leon's really good question. Now, here's an illustration. When President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began presenting a case by establishing a positive frame for him and his clients that created a distinct advantage. He would begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case. He would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were, and established his credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side and their very legitimate view. He then presented his client's side in detail. People then listened carefully because his credibility was elevated. The judge and jury both concluded that if he were so willing to give credibility to the viewpoint of the other side, he must be honest and speaking from his heart. This frame of reference and understanding, this respect of the other person's point of view, establishes a common ground, a connection before presenting your position. Now, a sidebar note here. Remember the circle and the stick figure. Your best way of entering that circle is to empathically resonate with that person's experience. And when you join them, then you can go someplace new together. Here's the best supervision I've ever had about that process. Many years ago, way before I started mentor coaching, was still doing psychoanalysis, I offered an interpretation to a woman who was in analysis, an executive, and I thought it was something that would be particularly useful to her, but there was silence. And then finally, she she responded by getting up on her elbow, and I knew something was up, looking back at me and said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." The most elegant, succinct, wise statement about what a true empathic resonance and working alliance is. We have to be with that person in the circle before they can go someplace new with us. Whether you're making a recommendation for coaching, whether you're engaging in a conversation with them, or looking at introducing them to some product you offer, even indirectly. Now, for persuasion science, I want to consider with you the twin forces of pleasure and pain. Our aversion to loss is hardwired. We learn more quickly from pain than from pleasure because negative stimuli get more attention and response. Avoiding loss has kept us alive. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize by demonstrating that notions of loss are more powerful than focus on gain. He demonstrated how we register twice as much pain in the brain from losing $100 than we register from the pleasure of gaining $100, loss aversion. This means that people are more emotionally concerned with not making a bad decision than with making the best decision. So, from psychology and social neuroscience, we know the twin forces of motivation that drive all human behavior, the desire to avoid pain and the desire to seek pleasure. Those are hardwired. These two organizing principles of brain wiring to minimize danger and pain, to maximize reward or pleasure, are overarching. If we associate positive emotions or reward, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. Meaning, if someone buys your services, your products, they associate more potential pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone doesn't buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. And we process this pain and pleasure cues unconsciously within a fifth of a second. So this is not something conscious and logical and intellectual. So here's a master formula for persuasion. To associate buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain. Greater gain with action, loss with failure to act. Since people will do more to avoid pain than seek pleasure, both avoiding pain as well as inertia, the status quo, are two innate brain tendencies to be aware of. Short term equals pain, giving up their money, for example. Most people need to think long term to be successful, to look at what the potential benefits are in engaging with you in mentor coaching. Think about how much of what we do is to prevent pain. Paying bills, doing taxes, exercising, maintaining your car and house. Our brains are hardwired to prevent pain, to prioritize survival over improvement. This means that our brains are primarily a mechanism for survival rather than designated innately for success or fulfillment or growth. So let's apply this pain and pleasure brain formula to the three-story components that we talked about in last seminar, challenge, development, resolution. One, the challenge. Find the need or the interest that's not fulfilled, what your prospects want but are not getting. Two, the development. Show how to meet the challenge. Resolution. Clarify in your mind and ultimately, simply in a recommendation, the emotional and logical reasons to act. People want emotionally, but they justify logically. So for emotional motivators, this may be to have or be the best for their clients, to have the best relationship or skill set, to be fully informed, to be confident. Since part of persuasion focuses on avoiding pain, if you focus on price, this adds to their pain rather than alleviating it. And I'll go over how this would apply and sort of reiterate a little bit of what we talked about last time about a recommendation that you'd make at the end of a brief discussion or a sample session to rediscuss how that may sound. We keep things to avoid the regret we would experience in giving them up. That includes our money. Participants in a research study were given a lottery ticket, then asked if they would trade their ticket for a different one with an equal chance of winning. Less than half of the participants agreed, even when they were bribed by chocolate. When the experiment was repeated with pins instead of lottery tickets, 90% of participants agreed to trade. Pins are tangible and real. Lottery tickets are a story of hope. You get dopamine for a dollar. People hang on to lottery tickets to hope for the best and avoid a potential regret they would experience if they switched. And God, what if the ticket won? So from a marketing perspective, giving somebody $100 to be applied toward a future purpose or purchase either is a greater incentive than a $100 discount. Consumer psychology tells us that people will gravitate toward purchasing decisions that do one or more of these five things: reduce the fear of making a mistake, make them feel more in control, simplify the decision process, offer simple, immediate emotional benefits, and eliminate any obstacles. This is why I recommend to the mentor coaches I work with and the coaches I train to probably stay away from a bunch of options, you know, programs where you choose three options and are, you know, where first of all, the client probably does not have the information to make an informed decision. Plus, it can be sort of confusing. And if there's a decision paralysis, this is the way it's going to sound. This is the sentence that a no and a no thank you will take. Well, you know, I know I need to, but, you know, I'm going to wait until the end of the summer when my schedule clears a little bit. Or I have something coming up that by mid-September I'm going to have freer cash flow to do that. Think of all the different forms of no that you've heard. Each of these are a no. And the person, though, believes it at the time, and they do believe they need it, but they're saying no, but framing it in a way that sort of makes it more acceptable to them and maybe to you, by the way. So consumer psychology tells us that people will gravitate toward purchasing decisions that do one of these five things that we just talked about. So let's look at applying that now to six principles of persuasion. Persuasion appeals to deeply rooted human responses of mind and brain. Now, here's what doesn't work. Strategies that inform people about facts or reasons to make changes. Nobody has ever changed their mind because of information or data that you give them. If information would change behavior, we'd all be thin, we'd work out every day, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd have a lot of money saved up, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. I just wanted to repeat that just in case you're tempted. Okay? The mind and brain sciences can tremendously inform persuasion to determine decisions and results. How information is communicated can dramatically affect how it's perceived and acted on. So, here are the principles of persuasion. There are six, and I want to illustrate each for you to apply it to your situation. And jot down if you have any insights about how this might work for a best practice for you. Jot it down in the margin of your outline or somewhere, put it in an output channel if you think about it, and see if it still has the same valence at a later time. One is liking. We like people who like us, who are similar to us in some way. We buy from people we like. We prefer to say yes to people we know, like, and trust. So the application is find something in common, discover real similarities, genuine connection, and offer authentic comments. When I was about 8 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. I went to the big city close to the little town, population 720, where I lived out of the town on a farm. We looked at coats at three stores. That's because that's all there were, even in the bigger town. Penny's, Sears, and Monkey Ward's. Don't even ask, because that's all there was. At one store, I really liked the salesman. He was warm, engaging, funny, seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking at there was a light blue, soft velour with an elastic bottom, sort of a balloon effect. You pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you look really good in that coat." Nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. I knew right then that was the coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. I didn't particularly like the coat, but I sure did like that guy. I liked the coat even less when I got home. That salesman had done a splendid job. I could not grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a really nice salesman while I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. Now, here's an application of what I'm calling the Magic Johnson Principle. When my son and daughter began playing basketball in grade school, and I was coaching their teams, we had season tickets to the Houston Rockets. Two seats, and they would each do a draft at the beginning of the season to pick who went to that particular games with me, and we'd have dinner before the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were excited, each of them in their own turn, about seeing Magic Johnson. Before the game began, I gave him a little quiz. I said, notice how he plays and see what you can pick up about his strategy, especially about how he relates to everybody on the court. After the game, I had asked each what they noticed and to not tell the other who didn't attend the game the answer. No trouble with that. They each mentioned how Magic seemed to be great friends with everybody on the court, including the opposing team players. And I said, what else? And they had, well, the referees too. And I said, anything else? And they each mentioned in their own way some aspect of how much they knew enough about the game to pick this up, of how much he actually fouled, yet he never seemed to be called for the fouls. He was such a nice guy and everybody loved him. Exactly. Everybody on the court liked him. All the players on both sides and the referees especially liked him. And he genuinely seemed to like them. He was as expert at handling the ball as he was in relationships. They hardly ever called a foul on him. They participated in his success. They would be less likely to feel that they participate in that success if they had to call a foul and disrupt this flow of that good energy of experience with him. And this is a record. Still, in his entire NBA career, he only fouled out of 5 games. When people like you and sense that you have something in common, they're more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they like, know, and trust. People commit not to things, but to people who they believe care about them. This is what boots up oxytocin, the neurochemical system of connection and bonding. And we'll talk later. The first few words of a conversation can boot up either a connection system or a very different system that will call into question trust and guardedness. What are the factors that cause one person to like another? They're not all visible. 4 of the most common. One is the halo effect. The halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. Examples are kindness, honesty, intellect. We're always teaching people how to respond to us. Another, similarity. We like people who are similar to us, similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. Roger Dooley, author of Brainfluence, talked about this when he was my expert content contributor at my mastermind group recently, and illustrated it by pointing out how I had used something I knew we personally had in common in my introduction of him. I didn't really plan it for that reason, but it happened to work. Three, compliments. A guy who was called the greatest car salesman in the world, Joe Girard, said that the secret of his success was mutually liking his clients. He authentically liked them. And everything I'm talking about is, if you're not doing it authentically, if it's not real, forget about it. Each month, he sent every one of his more than 13,000 farmer clients a greeting card and a personal message. And the message never varied. It included, I like you. And people who knew him said he authentically meant it. And he still has the record of selling the most new cars of anyone in the history of cars. And the fourth, contact and cooperation. Things that are familiar to us are most likely to persuade. By providing people with different backgrounds with more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other. Mr. Rogers, for example, carried in his wallet a statement that said, frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story. Now, we are wired to socially connect with others. A study in Edinburgh planted hundreds of wallets on city streets. The wallets contained one of four possible photos, a smiling baby, cute puppy, happy family, or an elderly couple. Other wallets had no photo at all. Here are the percent of wallets that were returned. With the baby photo, 88%. With the puppy photo, 53%. With the family photo, 48%. With an elderly couple, 28%. And those with no photo, 14%. The second principle of persuasion is reciprocity. We repay in kind. People return favors. When we help someone, they'll want to help us. Think about that in terms of referral. This induces oxytocin, the brain chemical of connection and bonding. So the application here is give what you want to receive. Your income is determined by how many people you serve and how well you serve them. When we behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively and collaboratively, someone will respond in kind. We try to repay in kind what another person has provided us. It provides a sense of connection and closure. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. Of course, that's what partners do for each other. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelmed all other factors. And some of these are goofy examples, but it will illustrate. In one study, success in selling raffle tickets was most effective for subjects who received a Coke. The feeling of wanting to reciprocate to the giver resulted in selling twice as many tickets than those who did not give the favor to potential purchasers. Think of the address labels you get as a gift with a request for donation. In one study, shoppers at a candy store made 42% more purchases when they received a gift piece of chocolate when they walked in the door. When reciprocity is meaningful and unexpected, the size of the tips that food servers receive become impacted. To diners who were offered a piece of chocolate at the end of their meals by the waitress, tips increased 3.3%. To diners invited to take two chocolates from the basket, tips increased 14.1%. Now, in another scenario, after offering guests one chocolate from the basket, turning away unexpectedly, returning to the table to offer a second chocolate, tips increased by 21.3%. All of these were part of a devised study. The third principle of persuasion, and we're going to get to the answer to that quiz in just a bit, we follow the lead of similar others, especially in ambiguous situations when we're uncertain. We do things we see other people doing, even more so if those people seem similar to us. So the application, provide a context to guide or demonstrate adaptive behavior. Social proof is a way we demonstrate what's correct, popular, or acceptable. We find out what other people think about it. We even view behavior as more correct in a given situation if we see others performing it. In a study of donations to a street musician in Washington, D.C., researchers set two situations to observe the rate of donation to the musician. Then, at another matched time, whenever someone was approaching the musician, one of the members of the study would drop some money in the hat of the musician so that the approaching subject would see it. Viewing this act increased donation 8 times. In follow-up, not a single one of the people acknowledged being influenced by seeing the other person donate money. Instead, they came up with various rational reasons, such as liking the music or having someone that they were reminded of. They came up with something logical and conscious and intellectual. This means that basing influence strategies on what people acknowledges that influences them can have a high failure rate. People are often not consciously aware of what influences them or even what to attribute as the cause. And add specificity. A study in Great Britain found that the most remarkable success of getting people to pay delinquent taxes was the option that indicated the specific number of their fellow citizens living in the same zip code who were catching up on their taxes. Focus on behaviors that are frequently adopted and are desirable is the takeaway here. Social proof and other influence factors have to be authentic and ethical, as everything we're talking about. It has to be true, and it has to be ethical. It has to be authentic, or it won't work. Somebody can discern this with the same part of their brain that they make those decisions in a nanosecond before they're consciously and logically aware. The fourth principle of persuasion, commitment and consistency. We have a deeply held motivation to behave consistently with commitments we've made, especially those commitments that are made public to others. The application, write down and publicly declare a commitment. We're more likely to follow through. This, again, puts it in the output channel. So, here's a question I bet you've already considered. How can you persuade someone to keep an initial appointment with you? There's a study, as you might guess. A series of experiments were conducted at 3 large physicians' offices where patients, after being provided with a date and time with a standard appointment card, were then given that appointment card with the date and time, like usually expected. Another group of as much as could be matched, another group, half of the patients were given a card and then asked to write down the date and time themselves and to read it back to the receptionist. The result was an 18% reduction in no-shows for the ones who put it in the output channel. So the best chance of commitment being fulfilled is when someone takes ownership of it. They make it theirs. They make it part of their story. That's what the output channel does. There's less commitment when somebody else writes out the plan. We learn and remember best when we use that output channel. Taking notes, writing about what we'll engage, that's why we ask a client at the end of a session after they've summarized in a sentence or so what they take away. What do you commit to do then? what's going to give you some traction. In instances where it's not reasonable for the client to actively participate in this way, it can be more productive to get a response, such as an email, to simply check yes to confirm an agreement. This enhances commitment rates. These are all ways to help someone take ownership of their own stories. Now, we each have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we've already done. So once we make a choice, we then justify and rationalize that choice, even if it's not the real reason we decided. We gather data to confirm it, confirmation bias, selectively omit data that may refute it, inattention blindness. These internal and external pressures will cause us to respond in ways then that justify our earlier decision. We make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided. This principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. A desire for consistency is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of behavior, especially when that commitment is written or spoken out loud. So, both mind and brain incline toward the continuity of no change. A body at rest tends to stay at rest. Body in motion tends to stay in motion. So how do you make positive use of this consistency principle in your own practice? Think about, let's move to marketing now. To obtain a large purchase, start with a small one as an introduction to the benefits that you offer. Findings show that almost any small sale will do, like an ebook for a couple of bucks, because the purpose of the initial transaction is not profit, but commitment to introduce yourself to begin a relationship. You may do the same thing with a blog and develop a following, or a podcast and develop a following. This small commitment can lead to additional incremental decisions to continue that relationship and that information process. The fifth principle of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. The authority principle is an application of the halo effect. So the application here, expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-evident. When you need someone to advance your case or your product or your service, having an advocate, a testimonial, for example, can be very helpful. You're perceived as being more prestigious if someone is advocating for you. This is the idea behind book blurbs or endorsements from respected authorities. When you negotiate with an organization, first develop an internal champion with that organization who can provide you information and also can advocate for you. And that makes it the antithesis of a cold call. The sixth principle of persuasion, scarcity. We want more of what we can have less of. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. Opportunities and objects seem more valuable to us when their availability is limited. So the application here, highlight unique benefits and exclusive information. G.K. Chesterton put it very simply, the way to love anything is to realize it might be lost. Now, here's a very simple example. Caitlin, my granddaughter, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided she wanted to play with that bear as well. There were a lot of other toys around. There was no bear deficit. But Sarah was no longer satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mother, my daughter Lauren, a clinical psychologist, was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of that coveted bear, or to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing 4-year-old possession-oriented minds. Caitlin will later learn how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, popular trending stuffed bears. even the induced shortage of specific stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest her bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediate inspired desire. As all children do, they both have a radar for scarcity. The unequal distribution of wealth, tangible or emotional, is an illustration here. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When something becomes rare or scarce, it seems to become more valuable. The principle, when this happens, it enhances desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we react by wanting to possess it even more. Later in their lives, Caitlin and Sarah will contend with marketing messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number, only two left, one day remaining. We're not making any more of these. I'm saying this to protect you guys from some marketing efforts. Mimetic desire, one person's desire mimicking that of another, is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neural system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more valued the person, the more attention we pay to that mirroring process. This scarcity principle involves another source of persuasion. As opportunities become less available, we lose some freedom and choice, and we desire to preserve our established priorities. So we need to couple not just what would be gained by acting or purchasing, but also what might be lost if someone does not act or purchase. I'm not advocating saying this in a marketing message, but for you to think about. With increasing scarcity, let me say this differently. When an increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we may react by trying to possess the item even more than before. A related tendency is to want something that's been banned and presumed it's more worthwhile when it's limited. Louis Neiser put this very succinctly. He said, some people will believe anything if you whisper it to them. Here's an example. Many years ago, after I completed my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was also offered and invited to introduce a continuing education course in the evening for the professional community on any subject I chose. I was warned not to be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course at that time in the evening that had been offered to date by esteemed faculty was like 7 people. The average was 4 to 5, and occasionally courses had to be dropped because there wasn't enough registration or no registration. Now, I didn't know any of this at that time, but the first thing I did when announcing the course was to stipulate, in order, in my mind at that time, to ensure optimum discussion, a maximum of 12 seats available. I was an optimist, but I also wanted to foster discussion, and I didn't know anything about the scarcity principle then, at least consciously, I'm claiming. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up in the waiting list group. So here's a brief overview of these 6 universal principles of persuasion that apply the mind and brain principles. Liking and reciprocity highlight connectedness with others to generate positive association. Shared similarity, being together and acting together, creates a sense of unity which activates oxytocin, the hormone of connection. Social proof and authority both reduce uncertainty. Consistency and scarcity both motivate action. The most important thing in knowing and applying these persuasion principles, again, is to be authentic, to genuinely have your client's best interests at heart. Remember that all influence factors have to be trustworthy, ethical, and genuine. So, to conclude, here's an overview of the 4 primary tools of persuasion. One is relatedness and connection. For a long-term impact, you have to care about people and find a way to communicate that feeling of caring and connection. Empathy is a listening perspective of resonating with someone else's experience, including feeling, perspective, ways of thinking, ways of constructing meaning. That person's subjective reality. Our ability to influence and persuade depends not only on our ability to empathically understand another person, but to communicate that understanding. This is always a first step. State comes before strategy and story to empathically resonate with someone to build a common ground of understanding. Everything else follows. You have to get in that circle first, then you can go someplace new. If you're not exactly right, the other person will appreciate that you've attempted to understand. They'll correct you and go someplace new together, collaboratively. When you listen empathically and communicate that understanding, the other person truly feels heard. This is the effectiveness and the essence of effectiveness to be understood. The experience of connecting with another person, again, releases oxytocin, enhancing affiliation and trust. The more people trust one another, the greater the collaboration and shared information. Now, go back to that persuasion quiz at Ohio State University. The option that's the generator of self-esteem. The other four are markers. The students value boost in their self-esteem like receiving good grades or compliments more than the other four combined. The other fours were the other four were markers. The generator is what had the impact. The second tool of persuasion, autonomy. Having control over our environment and the choices we make generates the experience of significance, of effectiveness, to feel important, unique, effective. When you understand what people believe and need, you can then show them your product or your service or make a recommendation for your services to help them be effective to reach their goals and experience mastery. The third tool, certainty. The need to be certain that we can avoid pain and achieve pleasure is a basic human need. Our brains are pattern recognition machines that consistently tries to predict the future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. Think about how we repeat patterns, listen to the same music, go back to the places we've eaten, order the same food. We'll give up effectiveness or a better goal just to maintain that status quo because it feels effectiveness can masquerade as mastery. Change generates uncertainty. Even a small amount of uncertainty cues the brain's error detection mechanism, contributing to our resistance of change. We can increase certainty by making concepts tangible, such as how long a meeting will run, and explicit, such as the objectives. Much of the field of management addresses increasing a sense of certainty at times of change and transition. And here's a summary statement. Whenever two people meet, the person with the greatest amount of confidence will influence the other. Confidence is a state of mind that infers certainty. And as any state of mind, it's contagious. So these first three primary goals of persuasion comprise three of the basic six human needs: connection, autonomy, certainty. The fourth tool of persuasion, state management. Manage your emotions and states of mind. Focus is one of the couple of most powerful ways to regulate state of mind. We determine someone's focus by the questions we ask. That is our most powerful tool to persuade someone. And the way we ask the question frames the answer. We're going to explore this considerably in the next seminar. So, here's the art and science of explanation as a concluding summary. A natural inclination that we all have, an inclination to point out all available information and a rationale to why people should pay attention to it. Yet, When a medical doctor prescribes a medication, over 50% of all prescriptions are not filled. Those that are filled, over 50% are not taken as prescribed. Strategies that attempt to inform people to a desirable change have a high likelihood of failure. Even people who are in pain and go to an expert and schlep across town, or maybe now do a video, but go have that prescription filled, less than 1 in 4 actually follow that expert advice. So we all, to some degree, ourselves as coaches, have to overcome the curse of knowledge, the difficulty we have in imagining what it's like to not know what we know. The killer pairing, and I especially suffer from this, is wanting to share all of what we know. One of the most profound challenges is to speak clearly, simply, and briefly. Although valuable, the knowledge we bring to the table, especially if we get into a teaching mode, will interfere with our ability to engage in the conversation and apply in a simple, clear, succinct way. So these following principles from a number of neuroscience studies will heighten impact and retention. And this is a brief overview, and we can return to any of these that you'd like to discuss. The four principles of good writing happen to be the same ones as good speaking, and they happen to be supported by neuroscience: clarity, brevity, simplicity, and humanity. When you speak to others, they're going to fully process and recall about the first 10 to 12 words before their attention begins to slip. Consider the 10-10 principle. I introduced that a bit. Let me just spend a half a moment, and I know I've taken a little bit longer. I will try to summarize here. The 10-10, a collaborator of mine, Mark Wallman at Loyola Marymount Executive MBA faculty, did research on this 10-10 principle. What he did was to get people who were in charge situations like divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration, to speak only 10 words and then let the other side speak. And he asked each person who spoke to put two fists in front and raise one digit and then stop when they got to 10. The average time of resolution was 20 to 25% of the usual time, and the groups satisfactorily came to a complete conclusion that was much more useful in every instance that he did the study. He describes this and related aspects in his book, Words Can Change Your Brain. So these are considerations to heighten impact and retention, to focus clearly, briefly, simply. And I want to add one thing in conclusion. Following the idea that states of mind are contagious, have fun at it. My favorite grandmother said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So any brief comment or question, come off of mute now, and thank you for going on mute. Any thought or question or addition before we have to stop, if you don't mind going just a minute or two over. Remember, at the end of our fourth seminar, we're going to add some time so we can have a freer and open discussion, and I won't have to respect, you know, stopping exactly at the top of the hour. But anything right now you'd like to add or ask, just briefly. If anything occurs to you, or if you read any notes you may have written, fire off an email or jot it down, and we'll open with that in a discussion at the beginning of our next seminar. And again, thank you for the emails, the kind words, and the answers and responses that you've sent to those two questions. Feel free to fire off an email. Thanks very much. I hope this was helpful. We'll pick up right here next time. Take good care of yourself. See you guys.
Good night, Dave.
Thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Dave. Good night, everyone.
Thank you.
See you guys.
Good night.